Welcome to The Squid of Despair, unscripted musings on business life, leadership, creativity, transformation, and all the myriad of other work-life events that get in the way of a good night's sleep. Hosted by David Ayling Smith and Peter Taylor.
Hello, Peter.
Hello, Daz.
It's good to talk to you again.
I know, it's been so long.
It has been a long time, hasn't it? What's that been all about then?
I don't know. We've left our listeners hanging. We build them up. We get, we pass a significant number of listeners. It's all very exciting.
We did.
And then
we did.
We go off and do work.
That doubling between one listener and two actually was, I thought, quite profoundly important to what we're doing here.
If we keep doubling, there's something about a chessboard somewhere, isn't
there?
There
is. Grains of rice.
Quite impressive. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. No, and I believe it's my turn, this squid, isn't it, to postulate something for you to pontificate on. Is that the way it works, isn't it?
I'm going to try and repeat that. But absolutely. And I will say the magic phrase in just a minute. But first, we have to deal with the squid in the room.
What is the squid in the room, Peter?
We are not Squid Game.
We're not. That's no. True.
Yeah, Squid Game is a South Korean survival drama television series created for Netflix, which is quite impressive. I've never watched it. Have you?
I've seen Squid Game, the film.
But not
the spin-off.
Not the spin-off, right? I've seen neither. And anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about, it's kind of like a contest amongst a whole bunch of players, all of whom are in financial hardship, and they risk their lives to play a series of deadly children's games for a chance to win a fortune, I think.
Interesting. Well, like this podcast, what has that got to do with squids?
Absolutely nothing, actually. I don't know why it's called Squid Game. I think it was based on an actual South Korean game.
Huh.
But I don't know why it's squid, but it's huge. I did a quick bit of research. You know me, I like to be prepared for these things. I think it's still true, because I know Stranger Things is very, very popular. But it according to Wikipedia, it's still Netflix's most watched series with, it's just scary, 1.65 billion viewing hours during its first 4 weeks from launch.
Well, they're onto something.
Yeah. So sadly, we are not Squid Game. And so we're putting that one to bed. So that's it. That's the squid in the room, over and done with. And I'm now going to say, Daz, what is the squid of the month?
Well, I have changed my mind about this a couple of times. And I'm intrigued to hear you say you've been researching, because how could you research? Because you don't know what I'm about to say. But I've moved on from what I thought was actually going to be a really interesting topic, which I'll hold back for another time, in favor of. So, Peter, what do you think is the importance of humor in a business context? That's
humor
what I'd like
to say. Yeah. That's interesting you settled on that one. Yeah, I was going to go for that later on. All right, fine.
Just goes to show we were brothers from a different mother, or whatever the phrase is.
Oh, yeah, it could be. It's in a very complicated thing. I mean, you know, I like to have a laugh. I get bored if we have meetings, you know that. If I have a meeting where there hasn't been a laugh for at least 60 minutes, it gets quite tedious for me.
Well, and whilst that's important, Peter, obviously we know this is not all about you. And
yeah,
so I was hoping broaden it slightly.
Broaden it out. But I'm just saying, I always approach things with a reasonable sense of humour in most cases. I think it's a bond. All right, let's start here. It's a bonding thing. I think humor is a bonding thing.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it?
Which is what makes it so complicated, because we all have different types of humor, different sense of humor, individuals, culture, everything. It's all very, very different. You know, for example, we know a beloved German who's got a sense of humor, and it's quite interesting every now and then of what he considers a sense of humor. So, and I'm not just picking on Germans, I know that from other cultures as well. So yeah, it's complicated, but it does bond us.
It is. And I think, you know, I'd like to explore this, because, you know, being my topic, I have thought about this a little bit more than you have.
Well, I'd hope so. We're in real trouble otherwise, aren't we?
I'd like to give you some sort of segues into it, really. And I'd like to suggest that, you know, and this sounds very calculating, because I don't want to be calculating, because humor is actually very important to me in my life, and I do try and suppress my humor at work because it's not always appropriate, and it continually creeps out, as those that work me know. And I think for some people it works, and for some people it doesn't work. And I would suggest that in the hands of an expert, I'm not saying I'm an expert, but in the hands of an expert, I think it's a very useful tool, aside from being a very natural human emotion. But I think used poorly, it's very destructive.
Yeah.
So I think we have this dilemma where humor by definition sits on the edge. I mean, if you think about what makes something funny, and I don't want to go academic on us here, but, you know, just trying to reflect on the relevance of humor in work and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, perhaps being simplistic about it. If you think about the different sorts of humor, what makes you laugh, it's very personalized. It's to your point, isn't it? It's very individual. You know, it could be slapstick. It could be visual. It could be physical humor. It could be clever humor. It could be wordplay. It can be observational humor. It could teach us something about ourselves. It can be very abstract. It can be very silly, you know, which is your particular favorite, I know, Peter. And right. And it can be surprising, can't it? Sometimes you laugh because you're surprised by the punchline. You didn't know it was going to go there. And I think what's interesting for me about humor is that I think you said it well. It allows bonding to between people, and I think digging into that a little bit more, just to start with, and I like to go to a different place, but I think when people enjoy humor, when they contribute to humor, or whether they recognize what's going on and take pleasure from it, I think people are being themselves. You know, they're being authentic. And I'll make a statement here, which I don't know is true, but I don't think you can simulate joy. If you think about all the sort of human reactions that you have in a work context, and I want to keep this to a work context for now.
Okay.
You know, I don't think you can simulate joy. And I would say humor brings joy. That would be something I would say is a truism. And so for me, when you share a laugh with someone, or when you enjoy someone's humor, or when someone makes you laugh, there's an intimacy there, you know, in a professional way, not professional, but in a, it allows barriers to be broken down in a way that if work is about relationships, I think it's incredibly useful and nice. I mean, it's pleasurable, isn't it? It sort of makes the world go round for some of us, this.
Yes, I do. I do agree. I think it's one of those things that can create, you know, that kind of commonality between people. And I think it's one of those interesting things that certainly during the recent times when we've all gone virtual and Zoomy and all the rest of it, I think incorporating the humor has been harder into that, I found. Because when, I don't know, because, you know, certainly, you know, you both of us, you know, we started with, you know, jobs in a virtual world and didn't meet most of our teammates until very recently. And, you know, trying to build that kind of humorous connection. And then we had a real fun team gathering in Toronto, and there was a lot of humor, particularly obviously in the evenings, you know, when we were kind of that kind of social engagement that was going on. But it really I think connected us significantly more than we did have some humor virtually, but I just felt that face-to-face made a big difference in the team engagements and connectivity.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, as we learned how to deal with working remotely, one of the things that people did use, you know, I think successfully, was humor, wasn't it, in order to connect, because it's so hard to connect when you're sitting, you know, with a screen between you. And, you know, you did some of this, didn't it? And you know, it was forced, but we were getting people to laugh and be silly. I remember before I applied for my latest job, and I was chatting with you about the challenges of being known in a situation where you were divided by a screen. And I'd shared with you the family competition that I'd been through during lockdown of doing a short video film of our montage of our favorite film. Do you remember I did The Matrix? And you said to me, if you want, you know, your new boss and your team to know you, show them the video.
and listeners, a little side note here, it's a very, very, very funny video. And it probably will never see the light of day beyond people who shared with it already. But trust me, it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Well, and, you know, I actually did share it, and, you know, it in a silly sort of way, it sort of defined a relationship with a few people, because it showed me in a different light. And I think that's the second thing about humor. You actually can be authentic when you're funny in a way that I don't know, is I think particular to joking and being silly. And a big caveat here, not everyone likes this, right? Not everyone has the same sense of humor, but a lot of people are uncomfortable with this. And so if one's going to be respectful and inclusive, I think that's the other side of humor. You have to be incredibly careful how you use it. But I do know that when it works, it's a magical mechanism to get people real close, real quick.
Absolutely. So look, can I share something at this point?
Well, one of the reasons I did this is I thought you could then reprieve all of your project manager jokes and your stand-up career, which I know is something you've been hankering to get back to for many years now.
No, that's fine. Yes, I did a little bit of stand-up training, and it's a brutal career path I felt discovered. But no, the thing I was going to share was that, you know, when we went into lockdown craziness, and I thought, well, and I was seeing a lot of, both of us are on LinkedIn. I'm highly active on LinkedIn. But I've seen a lot of comments from project managers where their projects are stalled, where they're in, you know, with their companies in some cases they let them go or suspended their contract and stuff like that. And I thought, how can I help out? And I started thinking about some of the things I could do. But then I saw a lot of other people posting great stuff. And then I really struggled. And then I remember that one of my early books was The Project Manager Who Smiled, why fun is such a valuable thing on a project.
So, Peter, I just want to bet here. So I made a little note to myself. Thank you. Under 15 minutes to mention one of your books that was relevant to one of our topics.
Is this like placement bingo or something?
It's exactly like placement bingo. But you have written a book on humor.
Right. I'm sorry. Other project management books on fun are available. Actually, they're not. I've never seen another one.
No, I've never seen
one. Right. Anyway, what I did was I started giving it away on LinkedIn, on social media, etc. Anybody wanted a copy of the book, the PDF version? And it was huge. And I don't know how many thousands of books were given away. And I don't know how many people read all of it or any of it, really. But the whole point was someone would contact me and I should say, here's the book for free. Give it to all your friends and colleagues if you like it once you've read it. You spread it for free. And I also did, about 20 presentations for free as well, all about the value of fun. And it was, free, just because something's free doesn't always make it popular, but it was hugely popular for a period of time. And I incorporated a lot of things around the kind of dark humor of what was going on and the whole situation we're in. I think it really was very bonding in many cases.
Yeah. And so, for those of us that, humor is an important part of how we function in terms of, it's like air, water, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, all of that stuff. Humor for me is one of those components, and a life without humor would be untenable for me. And so for me, it's very important. I suspect it is for lots of people, and I suspect it isn't for lots of people as well. So, want to respect that. But thinking about humor as a tool, and I don't want to be too analytical here, but when you see someone using humor well, just like to offer some sort of scenarios in which humor actually is an incredibly useful business tool used, well. And I want to come back to when it's not used well. But I think humor can diffuse tension. There are ways in which humor can, divert people away from confrontation. It can soften bad news in a positive way. And it can provide a sort of a social lubricant in situations where people are being adversarial. And so it's a common denominator, I think, for many of us. And so it's just interesting when you see a practitioner just being skilled with bringing teams together with humor or reducing tension through humor or actually perhaps communicating through humor. I think without being too heavy about it, I think humor can be used as an allegory, really, as a metaphor. You can use a joke. You can use a scenario which is funny to illustrate a point that is subliminally made and probably better received than if you made the direct point. I may be making all of this up, but I think it's true.
No, I'm quickly going through some of my notes from when I was putting the book together now. And I mean, they're kind of It reminded me of that. There are kind of three main theories around humor, and one is that there's the relief theory, which is, a joke releases attention in an environment, which I think you've touched on too. There's the superiority theory, which is all about why we laugh at others' misfortunes. Not in a cruel way always, but that's just the terminology that's used. And then the incongruity theory, which when two contrasting distinct ideas just mix together to create something humorous. And, it's a kind of core of humor.
Yeah. And perhaps moving on to where humor can be damaging. I had a coach once that I was reflecting. In fact, I went through a coaching experience with a team of mine. I hesitate to say that was pre-you, Peter, because I can't think of a time pre-you. But
I've always been your life, Dad, since before we met. I am your spirit animal.
You were there. Oh, that's an interesting follow-up conversation we should have. So went through a sort of a leadership development program with a group of colleagues. And I reflected to the coach that as a group of colleagues, and actually coincidentally we weren't all men, but we were largely male. There was a lot of jesting and joshing and sort of just poking and teasing and fun. And it was a really invigorating environment. And I think there is a male-female difference here, which I'm not really qualified to talk about other than perhaps to reflect on what I've seen. And within the male environment, this jesting and joshing was persistent. And actually, as a I led the group at that time, and it irritated me a bit because it felt like it was getting in the way of proper business conversations, because there would always be a comment and a bit of a joke and a bit of a laugh and a bit of a reflection on something that's happened before. And I said to the coach, it's interesting, isn't it, that humor is prevalent in this group? And he just said to me, Daz, if you look at that, there's always something there. If someone laughs, following a remark, there's always something there. And I reflected on that, and he was right. And I think you said it in your second summary there. It was a superiority thing. There was a very gentle, good-natured teasing, but actually on the end of a tease is someone's insecurity, someone's anxiety, someone's inadequacy, someone's mistake that gets revisited. And it's damaging. It's damaging. It can revert to bullying if it's not checked. And so I think we have to be incredibly careful with humor at work that's used indiscriminately. I think humor, we often see humor being used passive aggressively, where perhaps rather than saying outright, I don't agree with you, that's not a good idea, there's some humorous objection, which is funny, but the point behind the comment is, you're an idiot, or I don't agree with you, or actually I'm frightened by that. And humor is often used defensively like that, or passive aggressively like that, I think, which is very negative. I think also, the whole thing about, in the playground, a lot of small kids, and I count myself as a small kid back in the day, would use humor to deflect aggression. And you often find that, humor for kids comes out of, a protection instinct, and yet it becomes honed where it can be used as a weapon. It can burst bubbles, it can defend, it can wound. And so very conscious in a work context, the responsibility to use humor really, really sensitively. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Although, from the bit you said about, the playground, defensive systems, etc. I mean, if you look at the bios of some of the great comedians that we have, they will describe themselves as the introverts. They will describe themselves often with a background of, some bullying that's taken place and how they've gone to humor as a defense mechanism. And so, it's odd in some ways, I guess, that has delivered the world some of our finest comedians as a result.
Well, I is that odd? I mean, the pearl in the oyster, don't beautiful things come out of difficult events sometimes?
It's obviously not true for everybody, absolutely, but it's a common thing that I think with a lot of great comedians talk about their childhood, their upbringing, or whatever it is, and it has not always been a positive experience for them, and they've gone to humour and learn how to use humor in a creative way.
Well, tone that back a bit, you know, so tone that back a bit and just let's assume that, you know, all of us have experienced events that as kids we've used humor to control, to divert, to forget. And yeah, I don't want to be a pocket psychologist here, but, you know, as adults, we carry forward those defense mechanisms, don't we? And, you know, with some of the coaching work I've done, what I've found with people is those defense mechanisms they use as kids actually become saboteurs as they get older. You know, I'm not good enough. I'm not strong enough. I'm not beautiful enough. I'm not clever enough. And they, a lot of these saboteurs we carry around, which sort of tend to be self-limiting behaviors, it's really helpful to sort of acknowledge the fact that, okay, I get the fact that you're chatting to me here about, this is talking to the devil on your shoulder, about the fact you can't do that. I hear you. I know why you say that, but I'm going to ignore you and go for that job anyway. You know, that's the sort of work that I think we tend to try and do on ourselves. I wonder whether, you know, the use of humor as young people extends into the workplace. And so that's where you find the negative use of humor, or you find humor being used in childlike ways in a business-like context, which actually destructive, but actually your humor is so powerful. I don't know where I'm going with this other than say, I think it's a force for good, but it also has got to be done extremely carefully. And I don't want to be calculating here. I don't want sort of give the impression that I think humor needs to be designed for circumstances. I think it's a very natural expression and some people are comfortable with that and some people are not, but I think it comes with a health warning though.
Yeah, I agree. But I do think it, and I hope kind of the way I generally use it, you know, it is, you know, it's almost like a productivity mechanism with people because it does bond people together. It does connect people once you find that right humor. And there's a whole series of researches I remember where they looked into this and that found that you know, groups that had this kind of humorous connectivity actually were more productive, more effective, more efficient in whatever they were doing, the tasks that were given, than the groups that didn't have that connectivity.
Yeah, I think it's a communication, you know, it's like pheromones. It's like, yeah, well, actually I was going to go somewhere about dog sniffing, but I won't go that. There's a non-vocal language associated with humor, which when groups get it and they feel safe with each other, I think it just extends their ability to work together. But I think one of the challenges, and I mean you'll know, Peter, in my past I used to have the burden, which I loved, of course, of doing, you know, award ceremonies at company events.
Yes.
And I used to enjoy them, and with retrospect and hindsight looking back, I think it's actually, you know, I think I was quite cruel actually. But you know, it's the sort of humor where it started off with people, I mean, you look at the Oscars, look at the way in which Ricky Gervais worked and the various, you know, compares have worked in the past. That it started off with being, oh my God, he's being really rude to the, you know, the great and the good. And then the great and the good, once they got over the shock at being sort of derided in front of their peers, were then offended if they weren't included in the roster of insult. Do you remember that?
Yeah, so, I do. I don't think, honestly, I agree, you have been cruel in the past. And there are two things that come to mind. One is that horrible sparkly jacket you used to wear at awards. That was very cruel to everybody.
Peter, that is not true. You know that's not true.
It is true, listener. Mo, but the other one, of course, is where you left me dancing on a stage for an inappropriate amount of time. Now, that was really cruel.
It was funny, though. I agree that was cruel, but it was funny.
Well, it was funny to you and everybody else in the audience, and eventually it was funny to me. But, I had to the scenario was we had the James Bond-themed event, and there was the screen, and there was, like, we had some people dancing behind the screen at our dinner the evening before, and we thought it would be a great idea to do that again at the next day, and I volunteered to dance.
Well, actually, sorry, Peter, to interrupt, but just the full scene for our listeners. It was very James Bond-esque. You remember the broccoli sort of signature thing where you had the silhouette of the girls dancing very seductively in a round sort of telescopic sight type of view. So, you know, that was the image. And that was actually what was reproduced for the main event, wasn't it? We had some lovely women dancing, you know, in silhouette behind a screen in front of the audience with the James Bond theme being played. So cut to day two.
Yeah.
Over to you, Peter.
After a discussion around 2 o'clock in the morning, yes.
I
volunteered with one other person to dance behind the screen at the day event, for 30 seconds. That's what I agreed.
And for 30 seconds, it was, you were excellent. And, you know, we got huge belly laugh because it was funny. And you did the whole, you know, you just hammed it up beautifully. But then, of course, I didn't let you go and you'd run out of moves and it all deteriorated, which, of course, was even funnier.
Oh, yeah. When you end up doing the birdie song dance, it was desperation. And then, listener, just to get the background to this, what Daz was actually doing was inviting me on stage to announce the release of our global methodology. So, and I was up on some gantry up above the stage. So he gave me no warning whatsoever. And I arrived on stage out of breath and, it wasn't a great start.
Oh, but it was memorable. You know, you've remembered it, I've remembered it. Anyone that's listened to this podcast that were there will remember it. I, many, many years ago at a conference, I went on stage with an inflatable banana and gave my presentation on transformation. And I walked off with the inflatable banana at the end. I never referenced it. And everyone said to me, you know, over drinks and dinner the next day, what was the inflatable banana about? And I said, well, nothing. But the point was, they remembered it. You know, they remembered the idiot that came on with the inflatable banana. And they linked, you know, a few things I said with that memory of the inflatable banana. And so I think, you know, I think that was about making you memorable, Peter.
Yeah.
And it worked, obviously.
It was. Let's move on.
Because you've remembered it. Well, where I was going to go with the fact that we all have different relationships with humour, and just finishing off my story of being the compere at various events, one of my sort of checkpoints, whether I've got the tone right, is, you know, Beverly would come to these corporate events with me. My wife would come to these corporate events with me, and she'd be having a bath before the event. And I'd go in and I'd run through the speech with her, and she'd say, "You can't say that." And I knew I'd got it right.
Okay.
Having been married for many years to Beverly, I know that, you know, if I pinged Beverly with something that's inappropriate, it's probably going to be funny for everyone else. And actually, the thing that she put her foot down, which I eventually included, which made everyone laugh apart from the butt of my joke, was there was a character called Gary Cusworth, who you'll remember, Peter.
Oh, Gary, yeah.
And I think the opening remark was, there are many things I could say about Gary Cusworth, and some of them are nice. And his wife thought that was hilarious. Beverly had vetoed that, and so I put it in, and it, you know, that was the one that got me into the most trouble and actually got the most laughs on the night. So you've got to be ever so careful with humour.
Oh, that's nice. And you're still happily married?
Well, not to Gary Cusworth, obviously.
Not to Gary Cusworth.
He's never spoken to me
again. You were never married to Gary Cusworth, no.
But that point about not everyone has the same sense of humour is an interesting one, isn't it? Because we've talked on this podcast in the past about team dynamics and how diversity is important, but it creates complications. We talked about language, haven't we? And how use of language within a group dynamic is very important. And for me, I think as humour builds in a team, you've got to recognise the fact that people don't have the same sense of humour. And humour can be very divisive.
Yes.
You know, there are cultural, you know, humour is often culturally based. And one of the, you know, you talked about the sort of, what I can't remember the term used, but, I said about the surprising nature of humour, you know, when you show a stark difference. And unfortunately, a lot of differences are sometimes to do with minority views. They're to do with race or religion or culture. And so I think, and it's very interesting at the moment, you know, the stand-ups will say humor is dead because there are so many areas we can't go to because it's not deemed to be appropriate anymore to joke about those things. And yet, for reasons which I'm not sure I'm clever enough to understand, people still find them very funny. But in a group environment, I think you shouldn't go there because it's just too fraught with difficulty.
Yes, it's like we're talking about different types of humour. Because when I did my limited amount of training for stand up, the guidance was, the guy he kind of drew up a circle on a whiteboard and said, you know, there's your safe zone, and you have got to get as close to that very edge of that line in your humour.
Yep.
For it to be really funny.
Yep.
If you go over the line, it stops being funny.
Yep.
If you go under the line, it's not funny enough.
Yeah.
And the challenge is to keep pushing yourself that level. And I'm going to tell a story, please, if you feel this is an inappropriate story, we can edit it out and this will never appear in a podcast. But
Well, actually, before you go there, I think we should remove Gary Cusworth's name. I think that might have been an error.
Okay. No. Gary Cusworth. We love you. Very successful salesman, wasn't he?
He was. He is.
He's probably retired somewhere in some vast house and just true. Enjoying life. And the chance of him listening to our podcast is also pretty close to zero.
True.
However, you know, there are many Gary Cusworths in the world, and therefore we don't know which one we're talking about. Anyway, so this was my experience, and it is a cultural one, because I was in America, and I love America, and I love many Americans, but I was in America at an event, and it was a leadership event, and it finally got down to my level in the organization. You went much earlier than me, obviously, because you're smarter and more senior than me, but I was eventually drawn in. And one of the things we had to do, it was all about change and transformation. And what we had to do at the end of the 2 days, we had to produce a little tiny video, not long one, 3 minutes, something like that, that was how we described us presenting change to external people.
Right.
And we sat around this big table, and there were probably about 20 people in my group. And there were other groups as well. It was quite a big community of people were doing this. And I pitched this idea because I just, my humor is instant. And so I pitched it. I said, because nobody could, like, you know, anybody got ideas and like nothing for anybody. And then someone says, well, we could hold some cards up with powerful words on. And then I said, well, we could do that. Or we could do something really funny. And it's, we all sit in a circle and like, we could say things like, hello, my name is Peter Taylor. And I've been working in the old ways for many, many years now, but I've gone through a transformation and life is so much better. And I've been clean of the old ways for nearly 2 years now, because we're having to project ahead and what, you know, future change state. And the whole group laughed. I thought, this is brilliant. And then gradually round the table, we went one person after another, said, well, okay, we could do that, but that's kind of emulating a kind of, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous or something like that. And, you know, what if, and there were so many what ifs as it went around the table. I watched my idea die the time it got back to me again. And we ended up doing this video with people holding up inspirational words, and it was really boring. But my conclusion of that was, look, I'll go with the group, but, you know, this is why you guys don't have Monty Python, because, you know, we're not brave enough to take it. But in that environment, I was shot down completely after they would laughed at it, which is the bit that made it quite strange. They started thinking about the wider audience.
Yeah. No, it's. I think, you know, humor by committee, I think, never works, I would say. But I think your point about being immediate is also true. I think it never works well second time round either, does it?
No.
Actually, the biggest laugh I ever remember having, you know, if we're on recollections, was I was giving a presentation where it was following a workshop again in the US, and it was following a really difficult session where we were trying to pare down a mission statement for a certain business segment, and we'd done nothing. I mean, it was just, we were completely divided in terms of what the priorities were. And so I was deputized to go and, you know, speak to the audience about, it was the reporting out stage, and there were several hundred people in the audience. There were like 10 groups. And so it was a big group for doing this sort of work in. And I decided that this was a defense mechanism. And I remembered a joke which came to rescue me. And I sort of stood in front of everyone. Everyone knew I was in trouble, because everyone knew, certainly for my group, that we hadn't come up with anything. And so what I said was that I feel like Moses coming down from the mountain with the tablets with respect to delivering against this mission statement. And I've got some good news and some bad news. So the good news is there's only 10. The bad news is thou shalt not commit adultery is still in. And that basically got me off the hook, because everyone was so sort of amused and shocked that I'd gone off piece with a slightly lewd joke in America, that I was able to leave the stage without explaining what the other 10 were.
We must point out that other cultures can also be offended.
That's true. You see, I thought for this, and we're probably coming towards the end now, because our listener, you know, has a 40-minute drive to work, as we know, and we've nearly done 35 minutes. So I thought you were going to just give us a litany of your stand-up routine, Peter. I'm slightly disappointed you've not told us a joke.
No, definitely not. We could tell a shaggy dog story. I mean, that would keep us going for another 10 minutes, but no. No, I'm reflecting on, I'm casting my mind back. I did write this book a long time ago, and yes, I mentioned it for a second time. But there were a couple of bits in it, and there's one is an exercise I've used many times in large groups, and it's where you get, you put people in pairs, and one person has to smile, and the other person has to try and not smile back. And it's very, very difficult. It's really difficult.
And what's the point of this exercise in a business context, Peter?
It's a business meeting. You know, you're breaking the ice, icebreaker.
Oh, I got it.
So, yeah, it just gets the tension going in a room. And you start to get, you meet someone or you start looking like, gurning at the person next to you or whatever. And it's very, very difficult. And the other thing was around the kind of, there are pieces of research which demonstrate that having a humorous and optimistic approach to life is actually physically beneficial. And there's longevity evidence on this as well. So you can live longer, especially in the business world, he says, bringing it back to business.
Well, and don't we all know the therapeutic benefit of laughing? I mean, really laughing.
Oh, yeah.
That was my point earlier, I think, about when I've laughed with someone, genuinely laughed because we've genuinely been amused by something that's happened, something that one of us has said. I have a connection with that person, which is, it accelerates our relationship for me, months, years. It's very interesting. And that may be particular to me, and maybe I'm sharing too much here, but I think that's also true for other people. I think, as I said before, I don't think you can pretend to be joyful. I think you could pretend to be everything else, but I'm not sure you can pretend to be joyful. And therefore, if you share joy with someone, you know them in a way that you didn't know them before. And that's really powerful, I think, in terms of group dynamics. So to summarize from me, I think humor is an essential part of being human. And therefore, it's an important part of what you bring to work. But it has to be done with sensitivity and care, because it's also very damaging, because it's a powerful tool.
You do have to. If you have to think about it, and there's any doubt, the guidance is don't do it. It can backfire badly. But I've just remembered a magical moment, and you probably remember this. We were out for a dinner, and I think it had been quite a tough business meeting, and I don't think everybody knew everybody. But we were out to dinner, and it was that kind of supposed relaxing moment. And the wine was ordered, and someone had to that thing where you have to taste the wine, which everybody pretends they know what they're doing, but they don't really want to do it. They actually want someone else to do it. But I know you're a connoisseur, but that's true of most people, I feel.
It's only because of the volume I've drunk, Peter.
You've practiced a lot.
Yeah.
But I don't know, do you remember we said, well, give it to the Frenchman, he'll know.
Yes, I do.
And the Frenchman was wearing this a very immaculate white shirt and everything. And he professionally picked the glass of red wine up, or the samples of red wine, the taster, swirled it around the glass and actually completely covered his shirt in red wine. Yes. And it was just a magical moment.
It was a magical moment. But you see there, you illustrated my point. It was a magical moment for all of us, apart from him. He probably still wakes up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat about that.
He's probably never volunteered to taste the wine ever again.
But there we are. So there we've had it. I think an interesting discussion about, the importance of humour in the business world. And I think you and I are of an ilk, aren't we, which says, it's a good thing. It's a force for good, but be really, really careful with it.
Yeah, no, I agree. Great. Good topic. Well done.
Thank you. Well, looking forward to yours, Peter. I shall start prepping everything now.
Absolutely. Very good. Well, listener, thank you very much. We've enjoyed it, haven't we? And I've been Peter.
And I've been Daz.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye.
You've been listening to an unusual podcast from David Ayling Smith and Peter Taylor. More information can be found at www.squidofdespair.com.